me feel so doggone blue to listen to that old smokestack. Drivers are rolling on, leaving me here behind. Give me back them good old days and let me ramble down the line. That lonesome train, I love to hear the whistle blow. She's taking the sun and leaving the rain and making me want to go. I've got the blues, longing for her company. Many miles from where I am to the only one for me. It's so lonesome here, waiting for the manifest. I hope that engineer is kind enough to let me be his guest. Pound to me, take me everywhere I want to go, get my transportation free.
This is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WAFT Champaign 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board. This is Sunday, December the 29th, 2019. This is the last Sunday of 2019. I'm going to be a snot here and say, you'll hear people talking about this is the end of the decade. It's not, kids. The first year was year one. That means the last of the first decade was year 10. This is not ending in a zero, so it's going to take till next year, really, for the decade to end. Was that relevant to anything? No. What is relevant is you're listening to the Prairie Monk Program, which is WEFT's weekly look at rails, trails, greenways, and whatever else Dave has been up to in the last week.
There's big arguments about where the decade starts. It's probably more convenient to start with the zero, but it's debatable. I wanted to say something about environmental education. I'm aware that it's a very broad field. It involves a lot of human interaction, and it requires quite a little bit of knowledge about a range of fields. And I keep running into people who would like to join that field if they could find out how to do it. So as I've been through this, I thought it might be interesting to record some of what my experiences have been. They've been extremely positive, and it might help for people to understand where I've been and where I might go. And so as you age, you look at what has happened in the past and what might happen in the future. So I I came to this country from Australia. Partially, I was wanting to visit and discover the U.S., but I also wanted to get a higher degree. I wanted to learn the science of communicating with people, and so I went to the local consul office and got recommendations for universities that might be willing to consider my interests, and I had six universities to deal with, and the University of Illinois provided me with an assistantship and the opportunities. And actually, many people from the University of Illinois had done exchange work in Australia, so I was not an unknown entity in the sense of there's an understanding between language and agriculture. I had been teaching in a college which was producing extension officers that were largely working in an applied science sense. I was teaching chemistry, and often there was a difference between the research scientists from a major university and the applied scientists that were in the field recommending applied manufacturing jobs or farm recommendations. The graduates from the applied science field were very popular in extension. They often went out with recent knowledge and could walk into a field and know what the problem was and give it an answer. The research scientists were more likely to walk into the same field and be more conservative. They would prefer to go back into their science and study the situation in a more academic sense. The teaching at the applied science level involved a lot of memory, and I was interested in techniques that would help to bring some of the science behind the memory into action, to at least bring some more of the science, the math, the physics, the chemistry behind it. It was in an era when RNA and DNA was being touted, and there were lots of biochemical charts that could be remembered, but the more important thing was to know what the principle was that was behind the chart. So I had a research agricultural degree from the University of Sydney. And I had a diploma of education, which is a year-long course in education, also at the University of Sydney. I also had been teaching at high school and college levels, and I had a heritage of art in my family. My mother was an artist, and I thought that I could utilize mass media, or not necessarily mass media, but media, to solve a particular problem. My advisors at the University of Sydney suggested that I come to the medical school in Chicago, because medical schools are very good at interpreting science and making sure that their information is accurate. If a pimple is going to be red, it has to be the right type of red, and it has to be able to transmit information to medical doctors and an assistants. I had an agricultural background, so I ended up getting an assistantship in Champaign. At that time, I hardly knew the difference between downstate and upstate in Chicago. And so I missed the medical facilities that was in Chicago, and I was not academically aware enough to be able to negotiate anything at that time. This was very new to me. And so I came to the University of Illinois, and I wanted to study the problem of how I would improve the distance between academic researchers and applied scientists. I wanted to improve my biochemical background. I enrolled in agricultural education because that was my background, and I was engaged in art, which I revered because my background was that I felt very at home with art, and did so at the University of Illinois. It was difficult to be in three different disciplines, because this was an era when many people were studying new information, and their studies were monolithic in a very specific manner. That doesn't mean to say that there was not a lot of more general study too, but and we're very dependent on those people. And I didn't do very well with the biochemistry because I chose a very sophisticated course, and I did not have the math and physics and physical chemistry that I needed. Education was helpful and involved science education. But all disciplines were concerned that my level would not be the level of the pure field. On the other hand, I got assigned to agencies that were very, very helpful. So in the background, if I were recommending to people doing this sort of thing today, and they didn't have a recognizable field of science education or environmental education, that they may be faced with the same problem. But there are resources, and so I was I joined the Agricultural Communications Division of the College of Agriculture, and they assigned me to Ag Visual Services. And I had an assistantship in agronomy. Those fields were very active at an applied level. This was a cow college, one of the assigned colleges that were put into action to give settlers who came often without a lot of knowledge of agriculture, and specifically of agriculture in Illinois. The College of Agriculture was an extension college to teach people how to drain, how to get rid of prairie, how to organize their lives. They were settling in the 1850s when houses were already sophisticated. You could buy a house from Sears Roebuck or Montgomery Wards, and it was prefabricated. You could get your fellow citizens to help you establish it. It would come by rail. Your barns and cattle facilities were the same, but the extension offices were wonderful. They would go out into the field, often with not more than a bachelor's degree, often with a citizenship in the state where they'd grown up and knew regions of the state very well, and they were revered by the agricultural communities. There were also an engineering extension, and there was also a people extension. And so the university had an applied base. Some of the things that were being taught were the application of fertilizer, the application of lime and phosphorus and sulfur, and it was a family affair in many ways, and I felt like I really belonged, and I learned a lot. I kept poking around in different circles in early television, and I was given the liberality to do that. Not only the liberality, but I was given the support to do that. I really appreciate the university's involvement in that manner. It's more common today. It has become a legitimate thing to take a problem and apply a group of very different disciplines to that problem and different personnel. So institutions like Beckman are designed to encourage that sort of research and application. Some of it very sophisticated, and some of it's very down to earth. And we appreciate both. I, at one stage, belonged to a school science curriculum development unit out of the College of Education. And it was designed to create small teaching units that you could take into the classroom teacher, and they could maintain their right as the leading person in that situation. These would be units that would not overwhelm the teachers so that the unit became a visiting person with perhaps a person to go with it. The intent was to have the teacher remain the teacher that knew the students, knew the situation, and could follow through with it. Most curricula at the national level are fairly well defined. If you're teaching chemistry, physics, mathematics, there are agencies that have worked for years to create a curriculum. And you don't want to deny that, but you could infuse something. Let me give you an example. If you are talking about hydrology and drainage and things like that, you're talking about running water and river development. So the school science curriculum project would organize a stream table. Now, if you're in water survey, you would have a very sophisticated stream table. It would be perhaps 100 yards long, and you could create variables. You could create different waves. You could create different flow of water. You could infuse different materials and do research. At the applied level, there was a little stream table that was no more than a meter long, and it involved the material that you could add, which would vary from clay to sand to gravel, and you could have a coffee can with a hole in it, and you could put water into the upper end of this stream table. You could rise up on one end to give it different velocity of flow of water, and you could catch the drainage out the other end with the aid of another hole and a pipe, and you could assess what the runoff was, the leachate, and this table was very simple and could be set up so that students could use it without a great deal of cost. And you could notice how a river meanders. When you have a piece of steel in between two hands and you push it, the steel will collapse into two sigmoid curves, one up and one down. That is the physics of how, if you have water with pressure on either end, it will do that sort of thing. So meanders are a natural part of the flow. And if you were to put a school on a certain point of the meander node, you could see that if you had sand as a substrate, the school could be washed away if it was at the peak of the nodes. It would pay to put the school nearer to the node or the middle between meanders. So you could really enjoy working with students in this rather applied setting. There were other fields. There were Foucault pendulums that taught students how the world moved, and there were biological situations that could be explained in simple fashion without destroying the credibility of the teacher. The teacher ran these units and and was in charge. The units were tested out to see that they were not telling people things that they could not understand. And so that unit was a research unit in a way, a research unit of applied information. At the same time, I was working with botanists who were had an assistantship in botany, and I was teaching 600 beginning students as a grad. There was a professor in charge, and I was a grad student. But there was a concern that this was a curriculum that did not have a lot of field work, and these were mainly school teachers that were going to go out and in turn not include field experiences and laboratory experiences with their students. So I then got experience with curriculum development, the inclusion of field experience. It's always expensive and dangerous. The university, for instance, is in loco parentis, in charge of students. So if you're in a dangerous situation, which is in the field, if you climb under a barbed wire fence and get cut, or if somebody throws a pebble and hits you in the nose and you get a broken nose, then the university is in charge. It's not adhered to that much, but it's always a good reason for not doing field work with large beginning courses. There was a brownfield woods and a treeless woods and a Phillips track, and these were all parts of the Big Grove, northwest of northeast of Urbana. And so the Graduate College Committee on Natural Areas, headed by Dr. Kendi, had done a lot to encourage the connectivity of these units, Brownfield Woods, Treeley's Woods, and Phillips Track. Didn't exactly succeed before there was quasi-rural development between, but it allowed remnant prairies to exist and remnant forests to exist. Brownfield Wood had something like 13 different species of trees, plus all the understories. There was development that went by. Early settlement had to follow Indian trails often. There was a Clark center in Peoria, and people would move along roads like Bloomington Road, which to this day is at a diagonal rather than on a Jeffersonian grid. Those forests were defined and their nature was stressed. They had a grid of posts that allowed the collection of leaves and litter to assess the energy balance of trees. Even the last journal I received from Life Sciences included recent reassessments of the vegetation in those forests. The circumference of a tree at a certain height, the open spaces or glades, and the university has done a good job of trying to maintain remnant spaces that would introduce students to their heritage prairie forest vegetation. We got bold and ran field trips to these places. That involves organization. It involves, if you have 600 students, you have to have schedules, you have to have buses, and you have to have people that understand their ecosystem before they get there, because they, when you get there, you may not have time to really educate deeply about the site. We would have students to do assessment of leaf litter and to dig soil profiles, and to do so without damaging the ecology, and so small groups, so you didn't pound down the ecology that was there. This, after all, is also one of the few places for serious academic research, so the teaching should not invade the site. So we had trails and a little booklet that still exists within the framework of the Committee on Natural Areas. We looked at test and measurement and started to look to see that there was more than multiple choice questions, that there was an ability to write a small essay that would relate to the field experience in a different way. We videotaped areas and allowed students to do testing with the aid of taking them to what they had been involved in earlier. And eventually the botany employed a full-time PhD to improve the curricula in botany. Similar things were going on in zoology and general biology. Dr. Kiefer was working with programmed instruction, where you could study at your own pace, not unlike what is happening now with many courses that are on the internet, and you move at your own pace. There were some students who came from sophisticated schools who already had biology and zoology and botany in their background, geology, geography, landscape architecture. They had this background, and they had their background from individual teaching at home, home schooling. So there was a unit for people who wanted to do more experimental things. And one way or another, that was a useful experience. It didn't necessarily lean to a degree program unless you were clever enough to be able to wangle that. I look at some of the important people in these fields. I can remember that a woman, Loretta Jones, in chemistry, had a PhD and a doctorate in education associated with improving the curricula for chemistry. And she and another person worked to improve that curriculum and to do so to include instruction that you could do at your own pace, and a real attempt to let students into recent developments and to explain them and have them tested in a friendly manner. Often this involved people who were interested in teaching and not so much in researching. So we have a nearby college that is Parkland College. It's an applied college, but the teachers there are excellent, and they often are better at teaching you the initial stages of chemistry so that you enjoy it and get excited about it and have a twinkle in your eye. Some of those teachers are also very good at structuring their courses so that students can go on to a major university like the University of Illinois, which is not easy because the standards are different and the teaching style is different. At the university, sometimes research dominates teaching, and students that are very intelligent are expected to pick up in their own manner and do interesting things to the extent that sometimes the students become more sophisticated than their graduate advisors, but that is allowed and encouraged, and it's not without challenges, but it's the sort of thing that if you were going to do environmental studies, no matter what it is, you can be a person. So the person that was doing the curriculum development in botany, for instance, was the sort of person who would set up in a community college somewhere. The university high school was sitting on the edge of Netscape and Mosaic and early text message and text testing. And so the curriculum lab was controlled by the College of Education, but the people there were excellent at working with students, a range of students. Many of the students were faculty students. They were experimental. They were not old enough, 10, 11, 12, to be employed by the universities as test and measurement people, but they would find their way into Plato and be very helpful in making improvements. At that stage, they had a very orange display, and if you wanted to go to a visual, you had to find the carousel that was on top of the booth and put on the slide. It wasn't integrated into the program. Program learning was there. There was a guy named Stoliero and others who were working with programmed instruction. If you can find your way around with the community college, with the university, and you can find people who take you on, it might be that you don't know what you want to do. So you may be finding friends and relatives that you can talk to. And some of those friends and relatives might already have established research units that you can join up with. And that might be your success. Sometimes that can be stultifying if you don't want to be in a certain domain, but on the other hand, it can be extremely buoyant if you're going to discover something that has not been discovered before. So as you come into these fields, you feel your way around. It might be that some of your work will go back into those extension divisions so that you're working within the field. And one of the things that was very helpful to us was the curriculum lab, which allowed us space and encouraged us to do what we were doing and to provide services to a growing environmental body that at this stage, you're the first Earth Days or Environmental Days was Students for Environmental Concerns supported by the YMCA, and various agencies were evolving. I can remember that Governor State was a new university, and it was oriented to environmental issues and planning and architecture and landscape architecture, and in amongst all these, there are artists, and some of the fields that have been growing have been very dependent on the visualization of ideas. And when you're at WEFT, you have to think about what you do as a community station. Is it possible to do things by radio? Well, yes, and we have a radio program. But yes, we have a video camera that records this program, and then it goes to a banner public television, and that allows we drop pictures. David is instrumental in dropping pictures into our programs, so that this program becomes a not only on radio and streamed on computer, but also it is beaming to a different population, which is oriented to visual expression. We're not always sure who's watching, because sometimes videos are child-minding or just on, and you don't see. But the potential is there at the moment. That organization also records community non-profit activities, like UPTV, Urbana Public Television, comes to WEFT on a Monday night and records music. And certainly that music goes out on the air and you can hear it by radio. But when you get a twinkle in the eye, the person who is responding on the microphone can add a thought that will make it. And pictures are often worth 1,000 words. At Urbana, they not only, both Urbana and Champaign have the right to, or they have the facility to record their meetings and to air them. and to train their employees. It's often easier to show a small video clip than to spend 1,000 words trying to explain it. A map is very helpful. So the problem that arises is that that costs money. And at the moment, Urbana Public Television is having a hard time keeping the service, which is very generous. Jason Liggett comes and he sorts out some of our glitches and problems that you can't believe. And we want to see that go. The suggestion has arisen that we have a new public service video channel that would be concerned with public service. And we don't have anyone at the moment to take that over. Independent media has been asked if they would do it. WEFT has been asked if they would do it. And the answer is those are two agencies don't have the money to do this sort of thing. So there you have a problem, not unlike the sort of problem I was trying to solve when I came here, was to do something that didn't have a formulated base, but there is a problem you know about. And in these days, it's more possible with the internet and other facilities for people to get together in groups and understand the problem and sort it out. Sometimes that leads to protests, and Jane Fonda, for instance, is currently meeting every Friday at the at Washington, various places in Washington, and doing civil disobedience in support of climate change. So if you are sitting in the basement with a computer and you are very oriented to that specialty, and you don't really want to belong to a physics or a chemistry or mathematics formal program, you can perhaps find a gaming outfit that might satisfy your artificial intelligence, your interest in computers. So there is the specialist. Gates himself did not get a degree. He did it himself. Wolfram did get a degree. He read voraciously and got a PhD in physics. But then there's mathematics, language, and there's geographic language, there's geological language. Some of it belongs to those extension divisions like the College of Agriculture, where they now have a master gardener and a master naturalist program. And it's possible to do things. There is a difference. If you're in planning and architecture at the University of Illinois, you belong to the fine arts. And so there's a more art background to extension type programs. If you're in agriculture, there's more likely to be a scientific basis. But I want to tie this into Heartland Pathways, which is our agency next door. And I want to say that some of the things we do with Heartland Pathways fall into the category of problems. So initially, the curriculum lab allowed us to do environmental aid blocks, a little bit like the school science curriculum project. We could provide a slide or a series of slides, or we could be invited in to be a royal opposition or to do a presentation, to go to meetings. These are all ways that you can fit in. And it is possible to do that and do it in an exciting manner. And sometimes what you do will help professors to do their thing. If you're in artificial intelligence, is that going to solve the problem of the extension where you have college-level people who don't have the background to be doing scientific research? How do we encourage those groups? At one stage, some 20, 30 years ago, there were no community colleges. Somebody had to get up and suggest that this was another form of education. At the moment, we're losing our newspapers. So how do you allow people to do the things that they would want to do? If you want to find a legal brief that is advertised in a newspaper, where do you go if there is no newspaper? If you have a growing population that requires the removal of arbor facilities in the Amazon, who will stand up and say that this is a pool for capturing carbon and water, and how do we integrate? The population is growing extensively, exponentially, and that means that we are constantly trying to find more food. Does that mean you go out into 10-inch rainfall and create a dust storm that moves dust around the universe? Or do you research the areas like our east central Illinois that are very rich then we have to figure out, can we have biodiversity? Can we have more than corn and soybeans? So there are lots of things you could do here. But we're coming towards the end of our program, but I want to encourage those people of you that are sitting out there, not always wanting to join a curriculum or a degree program, but there are other ways of doing things in our fond institutions around us allow us to interact and find people who are tremendously helpful if you are willing. I'm going to stop now because David has something to say.
Oh, wait, you've got 5 minutes. You can go
ahead. Okay.
Yeah. Another 3 minutes. Right?
So we have around the corner a retired cinema called the Orpheum Theater. And it's been rather wonderful because it hasn't been torn down. It has become a children's, children's science museum, and David works there. And that's another one of these alternate things. We it's a theater. We're just losing a theater, the art theater, which has alternate opportunities. So how does someone like David think about what you can do with this theater complex? So I think I'm going to ask him to say something about the experience of working with this museum, and what he wants to announce is a specific day. But I want him to say something more than that.
Sure. So, right, the Orpheum Children's Science Museum is where the Orpheum Theater is. It was opened in 1914 and had performances of various sorts up through to around 1990-something. As Dave said, they were actually thinking about tearing the building down, because that's what we do in America. We don't have Roman ruins around that say, look at what people did 2,000 years ago. Let's just tear this thing down from 1900. But somebody rescued it and said, let's actually use at least the, not in the theater itself, but, you know, the mingling area outside.
Well, the slope up for the theater's chairs,
right,
is sloped, mm-hmm. So it's not convenient in some ways.
Although it was great over the holidays, because we turned the theater itself into what we call the snow globe, and we put little kids' carts at the top of the slope and set it up to be as safe as possible so the kids could ride the carts down, kind of like you would go sledding down the side of a hill. So we can even use the other part for that. But one of the great things about the museum is the way we blend in with the community. Community reaches out to us to, for example, have events at the museum, and we get to reach out to, for example, Dave. Dave, what was the class you taught at Parkland? Reading the landscape.
That's another one of these things which helps people merge into doing things, whether they're family or students. Around for many years.
And the museum has an outside area, a courtyard, and when the weather is nice and the plants are growing, we've got pollinators all over the place out there. And Dave very kindly came over one time to actually talk with the children at the museum and explain what he knows about pollinators and the prairie plants, basically, that we had. And we do the same thing with lots of units at the university. We have a thing from the geese business school. We've had their people come because some of them do various kinds of scientific research, and they've come and talked with us about whatever it is that they're doing. There are people who work on a genome project. They're all over the museum. All during the school year, we have people from various student groups come and talk with our children to scale down the science that they're doing to the level of, say, you know, a fifth grader or a second grader. So we're just about done here. I should just mention that WEFT is going to have to go off the air for an entire day at some point. We need to move our transmitter. We need to move our, I just blanked on the word for the thing, our antenna. And that's going to take us off of the terrestrial air, meaning what you listen to on radio, for about 24 hours. We'll still be on. We'll still be here broadcasting, but we'll only be internet available for that day. We don't know. We are working with a contractor who's going to come in. It's going to take a 100-foot-high cherry picker to be able to take our new antenna and get it up on the new tower where it's going to have to go. And that's not the sort of thing you can just kind of pick up and decide, okay, let's go do this. So we need to work with that person. We will give you as much advance notice as we possibly can. And then you'll just know that, yes, you'll hear static if you tune in to 90.1 FM for about 24 hours. We will get back on the air just as fast as we possibly can. Dave mentioned the Orpheum Children's Science Museum. There are a lot of us who don't plan to stay up until midnight on New Year's Eve. But New Year's Eve is a great excuse to celebrate and have a party. So I don't know how many years the Orpheum has done this, but we have something called a noonday drop. So that's this coming Tuesday. The official party will be from 10:30 that morning until 1 in the afternoon. The museum's celebration will be a family-friendly event for children to experience the noonday drop with their family at noon rather than having to stay up until midnight. Noonday drop includes activities, music and entertainment, crazy hats, noisemakers, a countdown to the big moment, and a drop of more than 4,000 balloons at the strike of noon. So that'll be this coming Tuesday. There is an admission charge to get in. And that will be up the street at the Orpheum Children's Museum. If you're in town, you've probably seen the marquee for the Orpheum. That's where we are, and we're open at 10, but the official noonday drop party gets started at 10:30. The noonday drop obviously will be at noon, and then the partying in the theater will keep going until 1 in the afternoon. Besides there being an admission charge, there are discounts available for families that have link cards.